So may I begin by asking for your forgiveness for running so very late today. Apologize for that. I'm going to take the wise counsel of my son to just apologize and start teaching. You know, my daughter is married and no longer lives with us, but she still does Life 360 stalking on us. She knows where we are more than we do sometimes. Anyway, if you'll turn to Job 28. That's right, by an indulgence. Turn to Job 28, if you would. We'll jump right into this. Obviously, we are living in an interesting age. Technological age, for sure. I don't know how closely you follow or read about what is happening in the world of artificial intelligence. I certainly am no expert and can't claim to be following it that closely. But one of the things that has emerged in many of the discussions and projections about where artificial intelligence might be taking us as a society is that we could find ourselves at some point in the not too distant future living lives of leisure in which various manifestations or forms of artificial intelligence have removed so much of the labor component from our lives that we have so much more time to enjoy leisure, enjoy hobbies, enjoy travel, enjoy time with family and friends, these kinds of things. And this is not some kind of far-fetched, sourced idea. This is coming from the major players in artificial intelligence. In other words, this kind of sort of projection is not, you know, fanciful in the sense that it's coming from someone who's outside the realm of those who are actually involved in the development of artificial intelligence platforms. And when you think about that one possibility alone, in some ways, it strikes me as a projection that really encapsulates what I think Job chapter 28 takes us to. And I would simply summarize it this way, that there is a vast chasm between the ingenuity of man and the wisdom of God. How much more foolish could it be than for us to have a society made up of people who aren't engaged in fruitful and productive labor? First of all, as you well know, it is a defiance against the created design of God Himself. So if multiple layers of society and multiple societies across nation after nation in the developed world find themselves manifestly dominated by human beings living full-on lives of constant leisure, what could that result in? No problem there, right? It is the essence of folly to think that something like that would be a consummate good for humanity. We know, obviously, that it would be disastrous. In fact, it's not outside the scope of many sociologists and even many theologians and even many just sort of armchair, you know, pundits to say that many of the ills and problems that we face in our society today are a direct result of many of the modern conveniences and advances that we enjoy. We don't know how to think for ourselves anymore. We have too much free time on our hands. Everything comes too easily for us. We aren't prepared for any real trial or difficult circumstance. We can Google our way to any potential answer or direction or whatever it might be. And over time, that has produced weakness, frailty. It's produced illicitness, debauchery, further exploration into the limits of wickedness and evil and self-satisfaction. So just put that on steroids with an AI-consumed world, and what kind of society might we have? And this is what we come to when we come to Job chapter 28. Just by way of brief sort of interpretive introduction, I do need to mention that there is, as we've alluded to previously, as we started this downhill slope away from the cycle of dialogues, the three cycle of dialogues between Job and his three so-called friends. We talked a few weeks ago about some of the interpretive debates that are going on in this particular section, really beginning in chapter 26, 27, and carrying forward. And there are some who would sort of cut and paste from the text and move things around because it doesn't seem to them like this fits with this particular speaker or this particular person in the dialogue and that kind of thing. It's a fairly common position for some more recent Old Testament scholars. But this particular chapter is prominent in that whole debate. In fact, there is no shortage of debate and disagreement. There's a lack of consensus, really, around how to handle Job 28, particularly the question around who is actually speaking. Who is speaking in Job 28? If you have an ESV version, you'll see a heading there. It says, Job continues. Where is wisdom? If you have a different translation, it might have something similar in which the indication is that the assumption of the translators of your particular version of the scriptures is that this is Job continuing his speech. But there's debate about whether or not this is actually Job's voice in this section. There's even debate about whether or not chapter 28 really is in its right place. Should it really be here? Or possibly was chapter 28 not even really in the original narrative of Job, but it was a later scribal insertion that happened long after the actual inspiration and writing of this Old Testament book. So there's chapter 28 sort of is a focal point of this kind of scholarly debate. Some would say that there's really three positions. Some would argue, as the ESV translation would indicate, that this definitely is just a continuation of Job's speech that began back in chapter 27 in his response to Bildad. And really, if you just sort of carried our outline forward, it might go something like this. You go back to Job chapter 27, in verses 2 through 6, you have the oath of innocence that we talked about last week. And that's followed in Job chapter 27, verses 7 through 12, by this imprecation or this curse against slanderers. And then in chapter 27, verses 13 to 23, you could continue forward in your outline of seeing this as an ode or a poem concerning the fate of the wicked. And then you jump right into chapter 28, verses 1 to 11, and you have a description of the ingenuity of man. And then in chapter 28, verses 12 to 28, the conclusion of the chapter, you have a reflection upon the wisdom of God. So if you saw this as just a continuation and we were just adopting our outline, it would just be this flow from chapter 27 all the way through chapter 28, and this is just a continuation of Job's speech. But as I said, there are those who are of a mind that this is clearly not the voice of Job. This is not Job at all, so it clearly is not some kind of continuation of his speech in chapter 27. They would argue that when you look at chapter 28, and when we do read it, you will notice this, that this particular chapter takes on a very unique, more peaceful tone. It doesn't really, in tone at least, comport with the tone and mood that we see from Job in chapters 27 and chapter 29, the chapter that comes after it. So there is a distinction there. There's no question about it. And they also point to the opening statements of Job in chapters 27 and 29 that bracket this particular chapter. Both of those chapters begin with this phrase, "And Job again took up his discourse and said." So you have that beginning chapter 27, then you have 28 not having that opening statement, and then you have chapter 29 with that statement of Job taking up his discourse again. So they would point to that as a textual indicator that somehow chapter 28 is an insertion or it doesn't fit, the tone's different, the opening statements are different, there's something amiss here. And in fact, as I alluded to a few weeks ago, numerous scholars will take great liberties with the text to sort of reorient where it's supposed to be or reattribute it in ways that they think fits the overall flow of the narrative more effectively and more clearly. They'll take Job chapter 28, for example, and they'll say that Job chapter 28 is merely a continuation of Zophar's speech. You know, the lost speech of Zophar. Zophar doesn't show up in the third round of dialogues. And so they'll say, well, he actually is there. It's just that it's a scribal error. It's just an omission in the text. And in fact, Zophar's speech is contained in chapter 27, verse 13, all the way through chapter 28. So what we're seeing in chapter 28 is actually the words of Zophar. Okay, so you have these, and there are others who would actually take chapter 28 and they would say, it doesn't even belong here. This needs to be moved to the end of Elihu, the next person we're going to encounter. It should be moved to the end of Elihu and serve as a bit of a transition or a bridge between Elihu's monologues and God showing up and giving his monologues. So there's all these sort of reattributions and movements of swaths of scripture that might be in view in an effort on the part of some scholars and theologians to try to make sense of what really is a distinctive chapter in many ways. There's a third position that I think is a good position. It's a supported position. It's sort of, you might call it maybe a bit of a middle road position, but that's really not an accurate metaphor. But there are some that I think it fits well, that Job 28 is either a continuation of Job's words, or it's this third option, that it is a transition. It's written in the voice of the actual narrator or writer of the book of Job. You realize that the entirety of Job is not all dialogue or monologue. Even at the very beginning, you have the writer of Job giving narration, setting up the story of the book. So there is, I think, a sound and reasonable view here to see this as an interlude in transitioning from the three rounds of dialogue between Job and his three friends, and the three, think about structure, think about the structural importance in Hebrew poetry in this Old Testament book. There are the three rounds of dialogues between Job and his three friends, and then there are three rounds of monologue with Job, Elihu, and God himself. Okay, so if you think about the structure of the book, you have this first half of the book, basically, focusing on the dialogues between Job and his three friends, and the second half in monologues of Job, Elihu, and God. Okay, that's a structural symmetry that a scholar would point to say that fits within the frame of what is common in this type of literature. Francis Anderson would say this, by calling the poem an interlude, we find it appropriate to mark, by means of this meditation, the transition from the dialogue in three rounds between Job and his friends to the monologues in three rounds of Job, Elihu, and God. Because we think that Job is a story, and he's saying that as opposed to like a drama or a play, he says, we find it appropriate that this interlude is spoken by the storyteller. It sums up the case as it stands at this point. We suggest that here the author expresses his own point of view. As such, the poem has key importance for understanding the whole book. Elmer Smick from the Expositor's Bible Commentary would describe this position this way. He says, the unknown author who composed the entire book in its present pattern now uses another trifold symmetrical pattern within the poetry. He inserts between the dialogue in chapters 3 through 27, three rounds corresponding to the three counselors, and the monologue format in chapters 29 through 41, three speeches based on the three characters, his own wisdom as an apex. And then Derek Kidner says this, there is virtual unanimity on two aspects of this chapter, that it is a masterpiece and that it stands slightly back from the immediate debate, offering the reader a reorientating respite from the strife of tongues before Job again takes up his discourse for the next three chapters. It appears to be the author's parenthesis rather than Job's, since the serenity of the passage with its unqualified submission to the mind of God is very different from the combative mood of Job both before this point and after it. I like the way Kidner frames this up. It's kind of like taking a breath. And there's this interlude that the author is bringing to bear to sort of sum up. Here's what's in play. This whole matter of the wisdom of God that is bound up in some ways in the mystery of God himself that we'll see as we move into this. So this is the way I think that we could look at this and be standing on firm sort of theological, interpretive grounds to think about this passage. It is either, I think, a continuation of Job's speech that began in chapter 27, or it is an interlude of wisdom written by the author of Job, which is not uncharacteristic of the author of Job writing of his own accord and in his own voice. We saw that at the beginning of the book. Now, clearly, as we read this, you're going to see that it has this elevated, sublime tone to it that is very distinct from what surrounds it. But it is a tone that is fitting the subject matter. It is a tone that elevates the wisdom of God. And so it's fitting that it would be written, especially since it's in the form of Hebrew poetry, that it would be written in such a way that it has an air of peacefulness and sublimity and elevation. And that's appropriate to what the subject is. And as Kidner said, it is a reprieve from what has been really an exhausting series of debates between Job and his three friends. Really, ultimately, as we've said before, futile debates. I mean, here we are after these three rounds with these three friends, actually Zophar being left out of the third round. And there's really no resolution. There's no agreement. There's no restoration of relationship. It is a trajectory that is devolving into vitriol and false accusation. It is latent with words and tone that would only detract or pull away from restoration and friendship. And the outcome is that God is still silent in all of it. That no one really knows what the answer ultimately is, no matter how much they think that they do. No one really knows if Job is decrying his innocence, and if indeed there's a possibility that he is innocent, then how do you explain all this unique suffering? And God, Job himself can't explain it. He doesn't understand fully what God is up to. And it's exhausting. And you get to that point at the end of these dialogues where there's just an exasperation. And we talked about this where Bildad's final speech is, what, six verses? Five or six verses? That's it. We're just done. Everybody's out of gas. There's really nothing more to say. And then we come to chapter 28, and we're just sort of lifted up to consider the wisdom of God. It's helpful when you think about the ebb and flow of narrative and Hebrew poetry and the telling of a story and bringing the reader along in the narrative. It seems like it's a good, fitting way to think about this particular chapter. And as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, as I kind of rushed through kind of a streamlined outline that would take us from chapter 27 all the way through chapter 28, if we viewed this as a continuation of Job's speech, I'm just going to pick up that same outline for this particular chapter, and we'll just kind of divide the chapter into two major sections. The first section, as I already mentioned, would be simply a description of the ingenuity of man. That's chapter 28, verses 1 to 11. And then the second section is a reflection upon the wisdom of God, which is chapter 28, verses 12 to 28. There's certainly further breakdown that you could do, or some I've seen break it into three different parts, and all those are well stated and effective. But for our purposes, we'll just use these two sections to kind of look at this. Now let's read the chapter together. Let's get to the actual text. Verse 1 begins, "Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth, and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore and gloom and darkness. Searches out to the farthest limit, the ore and gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air, far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. That path no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud beasts have not trodden it. The lion has not passed over it. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eyes see every precious thing. He dams up the streams so that they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings out to light. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and Death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. Now, I'm sure you may have noticed that as you look at this particular passage and you think about the division based upon the outline points that I've already given you, you may have noticed that verse 12 poses two very important rhetorical questions. And these two questions sort of serve as a hinge upon which the sort of the poetic irony of this chapter swings. These two questions. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? And on the front end of this hinge, if you will, is this fascinating description of the utter marvel of ancient mining practices and accomplishments. That's what you see really in the first half of this chapter. You see in these verses, these opening verses, that even in these antiquated times, that men exerted a degree of just raw determination and unbelievable courage and indeed engineering expertise to extract out of the earth precious materials, valuable stones and resources, these materials that forged civilizations. That's what you see described in these opening verses. You see all the ways that man's ingenuity produced amazing outcomes that ultimately serve as the sort of the structural foundations of civilization and wealth and money and everything. That's what he's drawing our attention to. And he's pointing us to the fact that this required man not to... You notice that reference to tilling up the ground or food coming from the earth. But no. What we're talking about here had to be extracted from the dark, deep resources of the earth's core. In ancient times, without the advantage of generations and generations of innovation upon which you could build, the knowledge of predecessors to help you know how to do a thing better or more efficiently, these ancient men were able to achieve incredible things. And that's what he's pointing to, the ingenuity of man. In these practices, in these mining practices, you see how man was able to overcome the limitations of darkness. It wasn't as though they could string, you know, some nice patio lights down into the mine and plug them in. I mean, they didn't have power. They had to overcome darkness. I mean, you're thinking about going into the depths of the earth. Have you ever been in an environment where it's actually literally 100% dark? Right? I mean, it's something quite different than what we typically experience or think about or know as darkness. When you go down into the depths of the earth, you're talking about a type of darkness that almost has a sense of matter to it, a feel to it, a weight to it. And they had to overcome that. It talks about in verses 3 and 4, you'll notice there, it talks about putting an end to darkness and searching out to the farthest limits, the ore and the gloom of deep, deep darkness, opening shafts in the valley, opening up these corridors where light can come into the mines. I mean, the level of determination and work and effort, even the thought that this is how we're going to do this, the amount of time that was invested, the manpower, just to get enough light down into these mines so that all these incredibly invaluable materials could be extracted from the depths of the earth. They developed pulley systems of some kind. It talks about that in the second part of verse 4. It says, they hang in the air, far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. It gives this imagery of them being lowered down in some way into the depths of the earth for this mining practice. So there's a sense of courage and danger. Lord only knows how many men died just being lowered into the shafts. It's probably hard to even fathom. And they overcame that, and they developed some type of system, some type of mechanisms to be able to do that in spite of its danger. They even, it seems, were able to utilize and deploy some type of what you might just refer to as ancient explosive mechanisms or processes to break up the ground. And you see this in verses 9 and 10. Man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eyes see every precious thing. There's actually an ancient mining practice just referred to now as fire setting. Let me just read a little bit about this. It says, miners built large wood fires against the rock face for hours or even days, heating it to 932 to 1,112 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure how this measurement was done. They then doused it with cold water, causing rapid contraction and fracturing. The thermal stress often produced loud cracks, spalling or rock falling off, and even explosive bursts as superheated fractures propagated. This could, quote-unquote, assault or lay bare hard rock dramatically, simulating an explosion without chemicals. Loose fragments were then pried away using stone or metal tools. And then there's an allusion to this, it seems, in Job chapter 28, this ancient process of breaking up stone, of turning up mountains at the roots to be able to get into the hard, below the hard surfaces of the earth. It talks about them controlling the water flow. So you have this construction of dams referenced in verse 11. He dams up the streams so they do not trickle, and the thing that is hidden he brings out to light. I mean, all the things that they had to overcome to be able to extract these valuable resources. It's just, when you think about it, and you try to kind of, you know, it's obviously ultimately impossible for us to do, but when you try to put your mind back into a more primitive age, and you think about what was accomplished, what had to be undertaken just to get through the first step so that you could take the next step in a process that would ultimately lead to extracting these materials out of the depths of the earth so that they then could be put to use for purposes of a developing society or civilization. So controlling water flow had to be done. And they didn't have excavators and bulldozers to be able to do this, but they managed to do it. And then you get to verse 12. wow, look at what man is capable of. And again, the ancient writer of Job is writing in ancient terms, and he's writing to marvel at what man can accomplish in all of his determination. And yet in verse 12, all this exertion of ingenuity and skill, man is still not able to discover wisdom through these efforts. That's where he takes us. Look at all that man can accomplish. Even ancient man. It's astounding. By almost any measure. And yet, it's not the same method by which man obtains wisdom. We can develop technological platforms that we call artificial intelligence that will render work an afterthought. And we can stumble around and ruin ourselves in our folly nonetheless. This is what he's referring to here. There's an interesting irony, I think, associated with this when you think about Proverbs chapter 2, verses 1 to 5. Solomon instructing his son, he says, "My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." And what Job is calling our attention to is that man is the master of diligently, persistently, sacrificially, with tremendous courage and innovation, going after silver, but not going after wisdom as though it were silver. There's the disconnect. Man has the capacity to achieve much and remain as foolish as a newborn. And this points us to this. And then you have this reflection upon the wisdom of God. We'll kind of speed through this. Oh, wow. You notice there in verse 13, man doesn't search for wisdom in the way that he searches for silver because he doesn't know its worth. That's what you see in verse 13. Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. In other words, man values things that he thinks are valuable, and he goes after them, and it just so happens that rarely is that wisdom. Wisdom is hidden from the eyes of mortal men. You see that in verses 20 to 22. He says, "From where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all the living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say, 'We have heard a rumor of it with our ears.'" Even the place of death and destruction is like, I've heard of it. I got a sense of it, but I don't really know it. It's hidden from the eyes of mortal men. And this is what the modern man, in all of his innovation and all of his achievement and all of his advancement, from medical advancement all the way to every other, you know, convenience that we enjoy, man ultimately believes that this is a means by which he gains truth and wisdom. And what Job is saying and what Scripture says over and over again is, no, no, no. That is consummate blindness. You will never find it there. It is hidden from that man. Completely concealed. And this is another juxtaposition you see in Proverbs. And I hear the hordes. We're going to conclude here in a moment. But think of Proverbs chapter 8, verses 1 to 4. Does not wisdom call? Does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights, beside the way, at the crossroads, she takes her stand. Beside the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portals, she cries aloud. "To you, O men, I call, and my cry is to the children of man." You have Solomon giving us this picture of wisdom sort of standing on the side of the road, calling out, "Here I am. Why don't you come after me? So you have this irony in Scripture where wisdom, even James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, what are you supposed to do? Ask it of the Father who gives freely to all. So you have this irony that was presented to us in Scripture, and it's presented to us here in Job chapter 28, that wisdom is concealed and hidden even while it is completely available to the one who pursues it and values it the way it is to be valued. Who invests in wisdom the intrinsic value that it actually has, which is beyond the price of every valuable thing that could be extracted from the earth. Every valuable thing that could be extracted from the earth. And then we have this concluding statement. Wisdom is revealed by God, and it's received in fear and in faithfulness. This is what we see in Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. You see the same kind of refrain from Job here. That it is not us in our ingenuity. It's not us in our own intellect or in our own powers. But it is in us bowing before a holy God, recognizing that in all of our accomplishments, in the grand scheme of His eternal economy, we are nothing and weak and desperate, and we are utterly dependent upon Him for life and breath and everything. And that fear also promotes in us a sense of desire for faithfulness, to represent Him and His law and His created design with brightness and clarity to a world around us, so that we walk in fear of the Lord, in dependence upon Him, in a heart posture of consummate worship, but also faithfulness, a desire to reflect His goodness and His beauty and His holiness to a world around us. It's not in us getting answers to our specific questions. God, why is this happening to me? It's us adopting a posture of fear and faithfulness before Him that exudes a desire to glorify Him in all things, regardless of whether we suffer. Though He slay me, yet will I trust Him, Job would say. This is the wisdom of God that the writer is calling us to reflect upon before we transition into our next section. Let's pray.